Barbara was really kind of a aggravation, but I reported to him, I reported the two assistant directors of research at one time who didn't get along one damn bit. One of them used to tell me that if I did what Burke said, my God, he would get my ass, that I was not to do what Burke said. And Burke was going to get no place in the DuPont company with this fellow's reaction. Well, anyway, Burke went to England after the war, and when he came back, he was very high on what the British were able to do, and how come that over here we couldn't do these things the British could do. And at one point, he got up in a lecture and said, here they'd run onto this extraordinary photopolymerization catalyst over there at the ICI laboratories where he'd been visiting, and wonderful scientific development, and how come that over here we couldn't do things like that? How could they do it in England? And I said, well, they read our papers. I have a patent on that. I see. That's one of life's triumphs. But this then, DuPont at the experimental station were starting work on photopolymerization. And a fellow named Plambeck had been working on this.
Oh, yes.
And he picked up, Plambeck later on won the Carruthers Prize. And as part of his lecture, he did talk a little bit about how photopolymerization was advanced by the discovery of this catalyst that I had been responsible for. He sent me some materials. I ran across, actually, Blaine McCusick said that Plambeck had mentioned this in the course of his Carruthers lecture. I wrote to Plambeck because I hadn't kept up on anything, and I'd just like to see what was going on. And so I got this back from him in which he said, I tried to emphasize that the image-forming polymerization process developed were the culmination of work and observations of many DuPont chemists over a period of years. Your early work on benzoin methyl ether as a photo-initiator was particularly important at a critical stage in the photopolymer development. And this got work started outside of the department and outside of the experimental station and so on. But I think that, of course, that ultimately became a very large commercial business, photopolymerization, and but I don't know that DuPont ever made any money out of my invention, because I think before the thing became really big, probably the patent had run out. But
is that the patent you mentioned that there was your name was the only name on it? Because
yeah.
The lawyer spelled it was...
No, that was the DuPont initiator patent.
Oh.
This one clearly was mine, but the other case involved the initiator for polymerization of tetrafluoroethylene.
Could you say something? We talked about it earlier today.
We were looking for additional ways, additional initiators for tetrafluoroethylene. We were trying to overcome some deficiencies. We wanted a product that would mold easier. There were a number of deficiencies that we could recognize, which we hoped we could change. And I was responsible for the group that was doing the polymerization studies, and so I assigned the preparation of this a peroxide of succinic acid, and as an initiator, when the people who carried out the polymerization opened the polymerization bomb, the polymer was a suspensoid. It was at rather low concentrations, 5 or 6% or something, but it was in a suspensoid stage, and the colloidal dispersion, which would eventually settle out and which could be redispersed. But there is the question, if Plunkett could get a patent for opening the cylinder and finding the polymer, in a way you'd say, well, why shouldn't the guy get the patent who opened the bomb and found the suspensoid? But it was decided, apparently, by the DuPont lawyers that I had assigned the experiment When the product was brought in, I recognized its importance, so that I was the inventor in that case.
And you said that there was some feeling, they felt there was some feeling that having more than one name on a patent at that time was...
At that time, it was felt that the flash of genius concept was what governed patents, and that it was kind of embarrassing to have actually two people on a patent, and if you had a number of people involved who... it lessened the chances that you could get a patent, really, because so I think that was part of the philosophy of the time.
When or why did you decide to leave DuPont?
Well, we were about to be moved to Wilmington, and I received a call from, actually, Lee Smith, who had been advising James Ford Bell at General Bills, and Lee Smith asked me if I would come out and talk to them about taking a job with General Mills. And so I had, my psyche had had some dents put in it by that explosion on tetrafluoroethylene, and I was not too happy about going to Wilmington, really. And so I went out, and I'd liked Minneapolis when I was there as a student, and so it was a good opportunity, really, to go. I had great respect for DuPont. It was a long time before I ever ran into an alumnus of DuPont who didn't speak well of the company, but at least at that time it was a period when we felt moving to Minneapolis would be better. So.
And I believe you said you had one other major area that you wanted to discuss as part of what you did at General Mills.
Well, the thing that I did at General Mills that I think deserved recognition was the involved the use of a reactive polyamide resin as a curing agent for epoxy resins. I had attended a meeting, I think, of ASTM, in which there was great interest in the potting compound, so-called, for the insulation. You take these casting materials and put electrical components into a system and pour in liquid reagents and cure them, and you would. This was an important development. Epoxy compounds were vital to the argument, but the kinds of curing agents they had tended to be volatile. Also, they tended, people became sensitized to them, and there was a toxicity problem, and they were looking for alternatives. Well, it occurred to me on the way back from the meeting that we were making a reactive polyamide in General Mills, which involved acids, polymer acids made from polymerizing vegetable oils, and these would, among them, we had, although normally the bulk product had been made using ethylene diamine as the diamine with which you formed the polyamide, we had some with diethylene triamine, and so I thought you would have unreacted amino compounds in there, which amino hydrogens, which could act as curing agents. And so when I came back, I asked Harold Witkoff, who was in my group, to carry out some experiments with this, and Harold did, and it gave rapid curing and a product of unusual properties. And Harold was a very enterprising, bright young man. He recalled that he had taken polyamides earlier. He hadn't taken the ones with diethylene triamine. He'd taken the ones made with the standard polyamide. And when he went back after some months, samples that he had were still, they had polymerized. And so our patent man thought it would be a real good idea to go back to the initial case to get a date on this that gave us an earlier date. So Harold and I became co-inventors. But it was a legitimate thing. Harold kind of made his fortune out of this. He stayed with General Mills after I left, and it became a very important thing commercially to General Mills. So that and Harold, this did his career some good along the way, I think. But
I believe you said wasn't this the one where they did several million dollars at the last few years?
Yeah. Originally, it had been felt that there was no point to go around telling your customers, you have to take a license from us to use this product which we're going to sell you, because we were the only manufacturers of the polyamides. And so that the merchandising for quite a while did not involve invoking royalties for the patents, but they woman that was selling, had sales rights in England, began selling the polyamide over there and promoting this custom, and according to the story that Harold told me later, was she insisted that if she was going to make money out of this in England, it would involve collecting royalties on the patent, and that we had to do it over here in order to make it legitimate. And so General Mills then began collecting royalties in addition to what they were making out of selling the polyamides, and that Harold, I think he said they made $3 or $4 million out of the out of the licensing rights before the patent expired.
Now, you were at General Mills for about 5 years.
Yes.
And then you moved on to Kellogg.
Yeah, Spencer Kellogg.
Spencer
there.
Kellogg. What was responsible for that move?
Well,
Were you still doing polymer work at General Mills?
It was a general. We had all kinds of things we were working on. Polymers were part of it, but not necessarily even the major part. And when my move to Buffalo turned, it was an unwise move. When I was with DuPont, I had bosses who were well informed. When you're a research supervisor took home a briefcase at night with reports in it, he read them. And when I got to General Mills, I was kind of shocked to discover that the vice president for research once a month wanted three-sentence progress reports on each research project. Later on, when I got to Spencer Kellogg, I found you couldn't even get the management to read the three-sentence. But this was offered. One of these flesh peddlers came around who was a very personable fellow, and it was a chance for me not to be the director of chemical research, but to be the director. I was director of chemical research and development at that time with General Mills, but I could be the director of research and development if I went to Spencer Kellogg. It was a firm, a family-held firm, primarily. It was on the stock market, but the family held the bulk of the stock. And it had been a very honorable firm that had was in a business where it was making little in the way of profits. And there was the current head of the company was determined that he was going to modernize things. So he'd hired this bright fellow who came and talked to me, and we were the reform movement in the company. Well, it really turned out that the bulk of the people there felt if the price of linseed oil would only go up, they wouldn't have to put up with all that stuff. And so, although we built a new research laboratory and we had some new products coming along that were fairly promising, it was an extremely frustrating business. And eventually, Howard Kellogg concluded that I was more of a nuisance than an asset, really. So I was being encouraged to move. And just about this time, the head of chemistry opened up at the University of Idaho. And I wouldn't have known about it except Gordon Harris, who was at the University of Buffalo. Apparently, they sent out letters asking for nominees, and Gordon Harris turned in my name. And so I received inquiries, and I knew what I wanted to do. And I always thought being head of chemistry at the University of Idaho would be the ideal job. And so I went back as head of the physical science division. I was responsible for physics and chemistry administratively. Then later on, we split up the departments when we began to do better. Physics was at an extremely low ebb when I got there. I had hoped that I could start resuming some polymer research. It would have been difficult at best because normally if people move like this, they take young people with them who have learned the art and can go in and sort of get the program going. Well, I didn't have anybody to take along with me like that. And besides, I was considered a half-time teacher. I was administratively responsible for physics and chemistry, but I was a half-time teacher. I taught 6 hours a semester, and physics, we had an unbelievable situation in physics. In the Sputnik area, you know, and physicists were hard to hire. We had one fellow hiring physics when I got there who later on was a janitor on the campus. And it wasn't so much technical incompetence, but he was incapable of really facing a class when you came right down to it. And he was teaching junior and senior courses in physics. Well, we had other situations were equally bad, and so I spent a great deal of my early time there trying to hire physicists. I knew the names of the children of most of the graduating physicists in the leading institutions in the country. And it gradually built up, and eventually we split the departments. I became chairman, head of chemistry then, and then I retired 10 or 11 years ago.
How did you feel teaching after all those years of...
Well, I found it quite a strain. I'd wanted to teach. Actually, at DuPont was one period. I taught a course for the Essex County Vocational School System of an apprentice training program that they had on campus. And so I had enjoyed that very much. And I really feel I had skills as a teacher. And I always felt until I got retired that I always had to give my teaching second place. There were always administrative assignments that absolutely required attention, and it wasn't until I didn't mean retired, but until I gave up the department chairmanship, which I did the last few years there, I never really got a chance to do teaching the way I wanted to. But I had a lot of fun teaching in the last years.
And what areas were you teaching?
Freshman chemistry primarily, although I ran a pro seminar course for seniors, trying to fit them to go out into the world. I taught that normally, and sometimes I taught a science for non-scientist courses. When I first went back to the university, we were just getting a PhD program started. The university really wasn't qualified either with equipment or personnel to do it, but they started the program, and I had to sort of teach whatever was left over. I taught a course in molecular spectra. Now, that was really quite a jar out there. I taught courses in polymer chemistry for several years. We had courses of that kind.
Well, you also became, I guess it's primarily when you went back to Idaho, that you became very vocal in chemical safety. Is that correct?
Yes. Universities hadn't caught up with the improvements that had been made in safety practices, and I was shocked by what I, of course, had known in my own university days at Minnesota, and when I came back, I was determined we were going to try and do it better, and so that started me, and then later on, when I was with the Advisor Council on College Chemistry, that was the NSF-funded program set up at Stanford. While I was there, I felt that this was a chance to do something on safety, and so I kept thumping this theme while I was with them. And Tom Lippincott, who had been one of the directors of the Advisor Council of College Chemistry, was then the editor of the Journal of Chemical Education, and he asked me to, or maybe Kiefer first. Kiefer may have been the editor and asked me, I can't remember which one, but one of them asked me to edit the safety column, and so I started doing that, and that led into activities in the Chemical Health and Safety Division and so on.
I don't recall the history of the division. Is it a young division? Was it founded recently, or has it been around?
It was founded recently. It was founded after quite a while. Not too long ago. I can't remember.
Were you instrumental in its organization?
I wasn't a leading spirit. I'd worked on the safety committee. I was essentially on the first continuing safety committee ACS had. A fellow named Livingston, who had been with DuPont, Bert Livingston, who had left DuPont and had gone to Wayne State University, became the first continuing head of the safety committee. I think the committee had been set up by the board of directors, and one of the directors had briefly served as the head, and then Bert Livingston became the head, and he had known of me as a DuPont employee, and so he asked me to serve on this committee. And several times later on, I was on the committee, and the activities of the committee later led to the formation of the division. And I wasn't so enthusiastic. I felt if we had a safety committee in ACS, I wasn't sure we really needed a division, so I wasn't enthusiastic, but I was in on the formation of it, and a charter member and so on. But
what kind of impact do you think your column and J-Chem Ed and others have had in promoting laboratory safety?
I don't know. I sometimes feel nobody reads anything. So I get few complaints and fewer commendations about the columns that we've had. And once in a while, somebody comes through and says that this has been an asset to them. I get quite a few calls from people who have safety questions, and I try to be helpful, get literature for them, and so on. I've been asked to participate in some of the legal hot cases. I've tended to ignore that. I don't think fast enough on my feet, and if you're going to be a qualified expert, you've got to have answers right now. And so even if I'm inclined to try and be helpful in a case, I don't want to get into it as an expert witness.
Did you do any of that expert witness years ago?
I had two experiences in DuPont, once where I was involved in a family row in Brooklyn between a dentist and his supplier of dental materials, who was his brother-in-law, and I had to be an expert witness in this case. DuPont and Roman Haas later were in an antitrust suit. The federal government brought price fixing charges against them in connection with denture materials, and I was going to be very likely have to be one of the expert witnesses was involved. And I was extremely uneager to get into this because I felt DuPont was guilty as shucks, and all I could say would be embarrassing to my employer. And it turned out that I got to go to the opening trial opening of the trial, and was tremendously impressed with the battery of legal talent which DuPont and Roman Haas had. They had the leading trial lawyers in the country were there, with the individual counsels for the people who were involved in the suit, and then DuPont and Roman Haas had their battery of lawyers, and they had this inept damn government attorney who was fighting them. And I thought, if I were on the jury in this case, I would simply assume that fellow had a better case than he was able to present, and that these people were overwhelming him, so I probably voted for him. DuPont and Roman Haas won the suit. It was there were some interesting things in it. The old Dr. Haas was kind of in his dotage, and at one time they brought out the fact that Dr. Haas, the head of the DuPont division, had called Haas, and he'd said, I'm calling you rather than writing this letter, because I don't want these damn government attorneys to get a hold of this. And so he called him, and Dr. Haas dutifully wrote this all down in a memo and put it in his file, and so it was later picked up by the attorneys. But anyway, DuPont and Roman Haas won, so...
Oh, that's great.
Those were my only experiences of that kind.
Well, we're running towards 4:30, and both of us have places to be at 5.
Yeah.
And I think what I'm going to do is stop at this point. Thank you very much.
I've told you some things that chemists don't need to know.
But no, I really appreciate the delightful 2 hours. Thank you for your time.
Well.